This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. What's it like to live to be 100 years old or older? A couple of years ago, reporter Nina Ellis set out with that question in mind. She spent a year on the road talking with centenarians. She produced a series of reports for NPR's Morning Edition about the remarkable people she met. If you heard the series, you'll remember it. It ran for a year, one report each month. It was the kind of series that grabbed your attention and didn't let go. One of the profiles featured Sadie and Gilbert Hill. Gilbert began courting Sadie in 1918. Let's listen to Nina introducing us to Gilbert Hill.
Sadie and Gilbert are New Englanders, originally from northern Vermont. They both grew up on mountainside farms not far from each other. On their first date, they went to a dance. It was 1918, just after the end of World War I. And after that, Gilbert pursued Sadie stubbornly. For a year and a half, he went to visit her whenever he could, on foot or with horses.
I walked 5 miles a night to get to her and walked back home after a couple of hours visiting with her. I'd done that several times in the winter. I couldn't get to her with a horse. But when I used to go and get her to dances, take her to dance, I drove around through town. It was 10 miles that way. Picked her up and take her to dance, and my brother would have another team at the dance, and I'd swap with him and take the horse that hadn't already been 10 miles and take her home.
So you courted by horse and buggy?
Horse and buggy, horse and sleigh in the winter.
Gilbert and Sadie Hill were married for 81 years. Another report in this feature featured 104-year-old Anna Wilmot. 104 years of age, she told Nina that she rowed her boat on a lake almost every morning. She also confided that once in a while she liked a skinny dip, but only when it's foggy and there's no fishermen around. Nina Ellis now shares these stories and others with readers in the book, If I Live to Be 100, Lessons from the Centenarians. Nina Ellis is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Give us a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Nina Ellis, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi. By the time the book went to press, Sadie had died.
Yeah, Sadie passed away in July, a month after she and Gilbert celebrated their 81st wedding anniversary. Mm-hmm. But Gilbert is still going strong. He misses Sadie terribly, but he's, by all accounts, doing quite well, still living in the same house that they shared in Central Florida. And I even heard that he bought himself a little three-wheeled vehicle so he could get around the neighborhood and do his errands because he had to give up driving.
Mm.
But, yeah, by all accounts, Gilbert is still going strong.
That's great. At the end of the visit, the end of the time that you spent with Sadie and Gilbert, you say you felt a tug toward them, and you kept making small talk in the driveway. You say, I didn't want to say goodbye because I knew I would never see them again. You know, I suspect there have been many moments like that.
There were a lot of them. And although as I got farther and farther along in the process of the interviewing, I met people who I did feel sure I would see again because they were in better health or more active or a little... Sadie and Gilbert were kind of shy people. They were very, I think, amazed and a little confused about why I wanted to come and interview them. And it was a little bit like pulling teeth to get them to tell me stories. So... And they were honestly getting a little tired of being interviewed. They had a lot of reporters calling them. So I didn't feel like I was going to be there again for a combination of reasons. But as the year went along and I started meeting people and staying longer at people's houses than I did with Sadie and Gilbert. I did start to feel that I could come back and visit with people again and again, which I did.
Yeah. Well, tell us more about the Hills. What did they tell you about their daily lives?
Well, Sadie and Gilbert had been dairy farmers most of their lives, and so they had worked physically, had done very hard physical labor until they were, you know, in their 80s. And I think that much of that life of labor sort of formed their personalities, and they were sort of quintessentially Yankee, hardworking farmers, and with a stiff upper lip, and you know, didn't talk a lot about their feelings. And but I got a very clear picture of how well they worked together all their lives, and what a partnership they had, and what a very close working and personal relationship the two of them had. You know, Sadie said to me, she said, you know, we don't just finish each other's sentences. We think each other's thoughts now.
Mm. You know, more and more people are living to be 100 years of age, but, you know, what are the odds that we'll hit the century mark with a sweetheart we married in our youth?
6 million to 1. Literally, 6 million to 1 are the chances of a husband and wife both making it to 100 years old.
Yeah, and I guess after 81 years, you could read one another's thoughts.
81 is a lot. I mean, we celebrate 50 and 60 years together, but just think about, you know, 81 years with the same person.
That's
hardly comprehensible to me.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you know, will I make it to 81?
81. Yeah, well, you live to 81.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, what inspired this project?
Well, it was a combination of things. I didn't really set out to do a series about people who were 100 years old or even to find out what it was like to be 100. I thought I was doing a history project, and my plan was to interview people who were 100 about the 20th century and to do sort of a people's history of the 20th century and to do a series for public radio in which those people told stories about major historical events of the past, and that's what I wanted to do and what I set out to do and what I actually got a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to do. But once I started meeting people and I realized fairly quickly that I was finding people who were in a lot better shape than I had expected to find, and many of them weren't all that interested in talking about the past and were quite eager, in fact, to tell me about their plans for the future. And once that started happening with some regularity, I went back to my editor and I said, I think that I need to switch the focus of my project because this is surprising to me. I had no idea there were that many 100-year-old people, first of all. There are 50,000. And I had no idea that there were so many of them that were doing so well. So with her collaboration, we changed the focus of the series from their memories about the 20th century to what it's like to be 100 years old. And at that point, it also then became sort of my search for how to live well at that age.
Mm-hmm. When that happens to you as a reporter, you're going out for one thing in particular and you come back with something entirely different or very different. Is that exciting or is that a little bit terrifying or frustrating or... that you have to change. You're going, oh, I got to rethink this. I got to. My questions are no good.
Right. Well, once you get over the fear of making that change, you realize you're in a new territory, and it is very exciting. It took me a little while to pry my fingers loose. the 3-page list of questions that I had so carefully drawn up about all the major historical events that I wanted to cover with them. But really, once I did and found myself in a complete new land, you know, as it were. And it was very exciting to me. And every interview was completely unexpected for me. As I got comfortable with that, I was very happy that I had made that decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was the series that we listened to on Morning Edition. Mm-hmm. Now there's the book. There's also a website that is fantastic.
Thank you.
IfILiveToBe100.com. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is something that's very important to you. Did you expect to become this taken, this passionate?
Not at all.
About these folks?
Not at all. That was the big surprise for me. I mean, I grew up in a family with a lot of older people around, and those people were great storytellers, too. And so I learned, the joy of that experience from a young age. And I've always enjoyed interviewing older people, but as I said, I had no idea that there were so many hundred-year-old people who were in such good shape. And, you know, in all honesty, I think 100 is different from 80 and 85. They have a range of experiences. These people, some of them remember, when the Wrights flew for the first time. So it became sort of a journey to a completely new planet for me.
Hmm.
And completely unexpected.
Hmm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Homewood, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is very interesting. What lessons did you learn from talking to all these people about life?
There were a million, as you can guess. I mean, every person, a lot of these people had very difficult early lives. You know, there was a lot of illness. There was a lot of, they lived through so many wars and the influenza epidemic and the Great Depression. They had a tremendous strength and drive and courage, I think. So I to be in the presence of that was very uplifting. And honestly, I'm not trying to evade your question, but I think anyone who is lucky enough to spend the amount of time with people this old, as I did, will draw their own lessons. I mean, there are lessons there for every person. But a lot of it for me was about slowing down and paying closer attention to my friends and my family and not, running around the world as much as I have been, and trying to be a better listener was a major lesson for me. It was something that, I've been an interviewer most of my career, and I thought I was pretty good at it, but these people, I had to learn a new way to interview people. I had to be much more patient and take much more time, and the rewards of listening with that amount of attention is tremendous, far beyond anything that I'd ever done before. And I'm sorry, the lessons I learned are not about really how to live longer or, what can I do to get to be 100 years old, because these people mostly don't know how they got to be 100 years old. But for me, the lessons were how to live, pay more attention to now and how to live a better life in the present tense.
Do you think they had any special coping styles?
I think they are very resilient people. At 100 years old, the chances are that you have endured a tremendous amount of loss, oftentimes a spouse, and many times children die before 100-year-old people. Most of their friends are gone. They've had major changes in their lives, where they live, what they do for a living. They're very, very resilient. They have a good sense of humor. But I think what helps that is a focus on the future and a sort of a tremendous kind of optimism and just a drive to keep moving ahead.
Very, very interesting. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This lesson of slowing down, what a great lesson to learn.
Yeah.
Why?
It was, it was a necessity first of all, because I thought I was going to be able to go and spend a couple of hours or maybe half a day with these people and come away with enough material. And I was very wrong. Because I had to turn the agenda over to them and sort of follow their lead and let them talk about what they wanted to talk about and then follow up. I had to spend more time of necessity, but then once I figured out how to do that and, you know, not to make a plane reservation to go home the next day or even the day after that, but to, you know, stay as long as they would let me stay and to just keep going back and at any time of the day that was convenient for them and just sort of handing the whole agenda over, that's when it really started to happen. That's when I really got a sense of the rhythm of their lives and, you know, how they spent their time. And, you know, if you just go and visit someone for half a day and they're all ready and, you know, they're kind of primed for you but if you go back the second day or the third day or the fourth day, then you're more likely to see people in their own element and in their own kind of speed and in their own routine, and you understand much better what their lives are like than if it's like you're there just for a special occasion.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I want to ask a question here, then I want to take a call.
Okay.
And then my plan is to play one of the pieces from the radio series.
Great.
But, you know, on this same theme, Nina, I want to ask you this. You know, when someone lives to be very old, we're likely to ask, of course, what's the secret of your longevity?
Mm-hmm.
And this was a question asked of Harry Buff by a TV reporter who, as you point out, didn't have all day,
right,
and was going to get 3 minutes to tell the story on that night's broadcast, and so he had to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
But Harry's answer was terrific. What did he say?
He said, stay away, eat all the junk food you want, and stay away from doctors.
That's right.
You know, I mean, Harry's joking. He's,
yeah.
And, you know, he knows he has to come up with an answer and a joking kind of answer, but... You know, I spent a lot of time with Harry Buff, and I've gone back to see him in subsequent years, and we still talk on the phone regularly. And, you know, when you let it unravel, you learn more about how he got to be 100 years old. And you know, he's got this joke about staying away from doctors, which is true. He does try to do that. But it's really about, for him, giving his time to other people and, you know, being
mm-hmm.
generous and living in such a way that other people will in turn care about him.
Mm-hmm.
It's something of a survival strategy at that age. You know, you can't be cranky and unpleasant to be with, or no one will want to be with you. So, you know, Mr. Buff and a lot of the men were very funny and very charming, and you just want to hang out with them for that reason.
Yeah. I want to take this call, and then the piece that I want to play is with a woman by the name of Ruth Alice. And the reason, I want to play this is because I think it says so much about the importance of being connected.
Uh-huh.
And also in that piece, you know, how we can fail to connect with someone because of age or infirmity. So that's the piece I want to play. But in the meantime, let's go and talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I just have two questions. One is, I was just curious that last quote Celeste gave makes me wonder, but I just assume that most people over 100 years old would be quite skinny. I don't know where I got the idea exactly, but so I was just wondering if any of the people you interviewed were fat. And then number two, I was just wondering if you got the sense that all of them were fairly positive about eventually dying or kind of still negative about it. And then I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, those are two really great questions, and I'll take the second one first. These people have been pretty much ready to die for a long time. You know, when they were born, life expectancy for an adult in this country was 47 years. So they, you know, they have sort of thought of themselves as seniors for many, many years. And they're quite, you know, ready and at peace with, you know, whatever is to come after they die. And that was interesting to me. You know, I was kind of nervous about bringing the subject up, but I was more nervous than they were. It was quite easy to talk to them about death. And the first part of the question about were there any fat centenarians, I didn't meet any. Especially the women were very slender and tiny. Some of that is their advanced age. But I saw pictures of most of them, and they had, you know, as younger people, and they had been, you know, pretty trim most of their lives. I should say also that I stumbled into a group of people, a demographic slice of the centenarian population that has never had a major illness. The New England Centenarian Study, which has been going on for about 10 years at Harvard, has identified this population of people, and they believe that one-third of the centenarian population is probably protected by some kind of a gene or group of genes, which has resulted in these people never having all of the illnesses that most people develop in older age, like heart disease and stroke and Alzheimer's. These people have never had it. I mean, some of them have never been in the hospital before. So, you know, they've been healthy pretty much all their lives. And they also have in common that they've been physically active. I mentioned Sadie and Gilbert worked on a farm. A lot of these people came from agricultural backgrounds, or at least rural backgrounds, where they walked a lot more. They rode horses, or they, you know, had a garden, and they were outdoors a lot more. And they were able and knew the importance of continuing that into their older years. Even a fellow who was a lawyer and a professor all of his life, he played tennis every day until he was in his 70s. So physical activity was an important part of these people's lives.
Yeah. And I mentioned Anna Wilmot in the introduction. Boy.
Right. Anna, is when the weather's good, she's still out in her rowboat every morning. She has terrible problems with arthritis now, which is very common among these people. Even though they don't have major chronic illnesses, almost all of them have arthritis problems. But Anna still forces herself to go down that bank to the river, I mean to the lake, and get in that boat and do it because she knows how important that physical activity is.
Yeah. I don't know that I would care to take a dip in a chilly lake in Massachusetts on a foggy day.
Chilly lake.
And I'm not even half her age, you know? Oh,
yeah,
boy.
Well, she has a really wonderful situation. What seemed wonderful to me, attractive to me, she lives on a lake where she was brought as a child. She was swimming in that same lake as a child, you know, 99 years ago. So this is a place where she feels more comfortable than any place on earth. Mm. So, you know, swimming, you know, skinny dipping there to her is, you know, it's like her backyard. It's her bathtub in a way. You know, it's her home. That lake is her home. And she feels, to me, it's a sign of how comfortable she feels where she is.
Mm. You know, I can imagine her saying something like, you know, well, I was 5 years old. It was about 99 years ago.
Yeah.
It's like, no lie.
I know.
Yeah. Well, 99 years ago. Boy, be able to say that. I want to move on to Ruth Ellis.
Okay, great.
Because time is flying by.
Okay.
What a wonderful woman she was.
Yeah. Ruth was a very... very inspiring lady. When I met her, she was 100. She had just turned 100 years old the summer before. There was a film made about Ruth by a young filmmaker from Chicago named Yvonne Welban, called Living with Pride, Ruth Ellis at 100. And I saw that film. And Ruth by the time I met her, was something of a celebrity in and was traveling around the country speaking with younger people in mostly gay and lesbian organizations. Ruth was the oldest African-American openly gay person known in this country at the time, and claimed that she'd never hidden her sexuality and was more or less discovered by this community of women in Detroit, where she spent her last 50 years. And they more kind of adopted Ruth as their grandmother and teacher, and they took care of her in the last 20 years. They arranged for her to go wherever she wanted to go, and they would take her dancing and take her out for a cup of coffee or celebrate her birthday, and they even collected money to send her on vacation whenever she wanted to go on vacation. They just made her their own. And it was a real inspiring kind of lesson to me about community and, you know, definition of community and family. Ruth outlived all her family members and was, you know, never married and had no children of her own. But when she passed away, 6 months after I met her, there were, you know, more than 300 people at her memorial testifying to how Ruth had changed their lives. She was a very generous person and, you know, had no sense of having been discriminated against, even though she had been all her life. She was just, you know, open-minded and generous and funny and wise and just an amazing, open, giving spirit.
Well, I want listeners this afternoon to hear that in this piece, because it comes through. All those things that you've just said come through beautifully between your storytelling and then, you know, through Ruth's own words. So let's hear this piece about Ruth Ellis.
Okay.
Ruth Ellis has no family left, no partner, and she never had children. But she's not lonely, and the years that we are most afraid of have been her happiest. If I tell you right away how that happened, you might not appreciate the struggles of her first 80 years. Ruth Charlotte Ellis was born and raised in Springfield, Illinois, where her father was the first African-American mail carrier. Her family was loving, but at school she was lonely.
I didn't have any friends.
Why didn't you have friends?
I guess there weren't very many colored in that school. And I had classes that were, I'd be the only colored there. And I think I was bashful or something. And the teacher called on me for something I'd tell her I didn't know. But I knew the answer, but I didn't want to get up before the class. One teacher slapped me because I was so stupid. Oh, Lady Powers. I told my daddy. So he came over to school and bawled her out. I didn't have too much of a childhood. My gym teacher, she's the only one paid any particular attention to me. She took interest in me.
In high school, she had a secret crush on her gym teacher. And gradually, Ruth began to realize this about herself. She was gay. She never tried to hide it, but she didn't talk with anyone about it either. Ruth graduated from high school, worked a number of jobs in Springfield, and then in the late 30s moved to Detroit for better pay. She learned about the larger gay world and eventually found a partner, a woman named Babe. They bought a house together, and Ruth owned a small printing business. They didn't have much money, but they opened their home to young black gay men and lesbians who were not allowed in the white single-sex bars of Detroit.
They'd come to our house for just enjoyment. They'd bring a bottle, and they'd play cards, and we'd dance and play the piano. Some of them'd be good piano players. Just had a place to enjoy themselves. One fella come from the South. He didn't have any place to come. He stayed at our house. Different ones would come and stay at our house till they find something to do, then they're gone.
After 35 years together, Ruth and Babe drifted apart, And so at age 65, Ruth got an apartment in subsidized senior housing in downtown Detroit. And even though she had no family members living and no pension, her best years began. She joined senior citizens clubs and enjoyed bowling, pool, dancing, and for the first time in her life, traveling. And then at age 79, she took a self-defense course from a young woman she had a feeling was gay.
Yeah, I was curious. I'd never seen a white lesbian. So I wrote her a little note if I could get better acquainted with her. So she came over to see me.
And when the woman introduced Ruth to her circle of friends, everything changed. She was embraced by a community hungry for a role model. Ruth doesn't like to say she's experienced discrimination in her life, though she will say being black is harder than being gay. It's clear that much has been denied to her. A good education, high-paying jobs, and the freedom to socialize as she pleased. Ruth chose not to hide her homosexuality, though, and today the women who surround her take hope and strength from that. Sarah Yulee is one of these women. Ruth took me to visit Sarah, who says she deeply loves Ruth, has found her true grandmother, and wants to make her happy however she can.
I think at first, for, 5 or 10 years, the main thing I did was make sure that Ruth could get to an event if she wanted to go. If she wanted to go to the National Women's Music Festival or just to a coffee house, we'd make sure somebody would pick her up and that she'd get to go. And we also work on trying to take care of Ruth's dreams. Like about, 10 years ago, somebody said there was a conference in California for black, gay, and lesbians. And Ruth said, well, I think I'd like to go to that. So we raised money, and she and a companion went to that conference. Then a couple years later, she said, I'd like to have a massage, or I'd like to go to Provincetown.
That's where I went.
This is like Ruth Ellis's Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Exactly, exactly. And the circle of friends is so large now that there is almost nothing that she could think of that couldn't be made to happen.
Why did this happen to you, Ruth?
I don't know. Just out of the sky.
And now there's a documentary film called Living with Pride, Ruth Ellis at 100. So far, it's been shown at gatherings in more than 80 cities in the U.S. and overseas. And as a result, Ruth is alone only when she wants to be. She gets phone calls and visitors and invitations to appear before groups. I went with Ruth to one of these events at Michigan State University, where a classroom full of mostly 20-year-old students watched the film. Afterward, when Ruth was before them ready for questions, there was silence. Later, many of them admitted they were afraid of older people, and none of them, it turns out, had talked with anyone aside from their grandparents over 60 years old. They stared at Ruth, a messenger from another century.
Now, don't be bashful. I'm just an ordinary person.
I would like to know, I think most of us in here are social workers, and I wondered what you would like us to know from your experience with social workers. What would you like us to know?
I would like for the young people to take more interest in some old person. There's a lot of old people that have lost their families, they don't have anyone. And I think if the young people would just pick out one person that they could go visit, take them to a show or to lunch or something like that, I think they'd appreciate that very much. I had a friend that lived to be 100. Then she decided that she was tired and she just stopped eating till she passed. So I don't want to get that tired. I want to live as long as I can.
Ruth Ellis has gone from being a shy little girl with no friends to a wise elder, an inspiration. It took nearly 100 years, though, and on some days she says she is tired of living. But at this moment, as all these young faces smile at her, Ruth is radiant. She practically inhales their energy, and it makes her just a little bit bold.
What do you think about sex education in schools?
You got me there, honey. You got me there. One thing, I think we deal with sex too early in life. You have plenty of time to have sex. Up to 95 anyway. I can tell you that.
Ruth is still traveling and looking forward to her 101st birthday.
Nina Ellis reporting one of the features in the 100 Years of Stories, the feature on Ruth Ellis. Nina is now also the author of If I Live to Be 100, Lessons from the Centenarians. And also there is a website, listeners, so if you'd like to hear the entire series, you can go to the website and hear the radio series. You can see photographs of the people that Nina got to know. And the website is ifiliveTobe100.com. What a, you know, again, I am just struck when I listen to this piece, all the things that are there. And, you know, I think that one of the things that just comes through so loud and clear is the importance of being connected.
Yes, and, these people know that on some level, and many of them are quite good at keeping people in their lives, and especially younger people. You know, a lot, we all joke about this, and we've heard older people say all the time they don't want to be around old people only because they just talk about their illnesses. But it's true for these people. They want to be around young people. And a lot of them have mobility problems, and, you know, what Ruth says to young people or said to young people was to go and find an older person and take them to lunch and take them to a movie, and what a big difference it makes in their lives. And she did that even, you know, into her late 90s. She made it her job to go around to many different senior centers in Detroit and visit with people who had no one, because she knew the importance of that human connection and that it sustains, that it's life-giving. Without it, you know, isolation is what kills people. Mm. So, it's a lesson. Every one of them has that issue that they have to deal with on some level.
Yeah. The other thing that was interesting to hear in this piece that, you know, here at the end, you know, you take us to this classroom setting, social workers, mm-hmm. young social workers, people studying to be social workers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's quite clear they're a little intimidated. They're a little afraid of Ruth. And mm-hmm. she has to say, don't be bashful.
Yeah.
I'm just a human being.
Yeah.
What is it that leads to this this segregation, this being away from old people?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of complicated reasons that it happens. Our families are separate. You know, we move away. We don't live in, you know, small communal groups the way we used to. So we're oftentimes not near even our own grandparents. We don't know them. We're not in the same town as them. We don't see them all the time. And I think, you know, our society is very much youth-oriented, and when you're young, it's easy to do nothing but hang around with people your own age. I mean, it's a natural, on some level, you want to hang out with people your own age. You have similar experiences, but because of the, you know, mobility that we have in this country, we are able to move around and make choices about who we want to be with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times people don't choose to be with their families or older people, and they miss out on a certain level on what that means. You know, I live in the Washington, D.C. area, which is full of people who've come here from other places, attracted by jobs and that they love and that they work at incessantly. It's in some ways a city of workaholics. You don't see 100-year-old people in your day-to-day life, unless they're part of your family or live next door to you. So, you know, it's kind of a hidden population, I think, and much to my surprise, a very large population of people.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of go out of your way to make those acquaintances, because those people can't come to you.
Yeah. We've got some listeners waiting to talk with us, and I want to go to them all in just a second here. But I do want to say that also I think that we when we think of older people, we think of our parents or grandparents, and especially, you know, for a person who's a young person, when you think of an older person, it's grandmother or grandfather. And, you know, you don't, you know, when you're old enough to understand that, yeah, my grandmother opened up the window on a fairly regular basis, apparently, during her youth and when she was in high school and climbed down a tree to go dancing. And you think, no, not you.
Yeah.
You know, so we have these
ideas. Imagine them as younger people.
Yeah, we have these ideas that, well, my grandmother was always grandmother.
Always old.
Yeah, always old.
Yeah.
Let's talk with a listener. Line one, caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was wondering if you talked to them about their feelings about religion, whether they were or weren't, or just.
Good question.
Yes, I did. Most of them were religious. It almost always came up. A lot of them, because they don't drive anymore, don't attend a regular service of any kind, but I could say that they had most of their lives, and they, you know, they were believers for the most part.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's take another call, a listener in Normal on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello. I just wanted to share that my grandmother turned 100 this month, so that was exciting for our family.
Yeah.
My question was how you chose with, you know, the numbers you did from the 55,000, did you?
50,000. Well, it was very subjective. Mm-hmm. I mean, totally subjective. I'm completely non-scientific. I wanted to have a variety of experiences and some geographical diversity. But, you know, I honestly chose people based on their experiences and what I wanted to know about, mm-hmm. what I was interested in. You know, there are scientific and very wonderful medical and scientific studies going on now about longevity, and I don't have that kind of training, so I just chose them based on what I wanted to know about.
Yeah, just kind of picked a name and met them and went from there? Or
you know, a lot of times I got mail from listeners mm-hmm. about their relatives and or their neighbors. Earlier, Celeste mentioned a fellow named Harry Buff, who lives in Rochester, New York. His next-door neighbor wrote me a long, very passionate letter about him and said, "You have to meet my next-door neighbor, Harry Buff. He's lived in the same house since 1925, and we call him the mayor of Belmont Street."
Oh, my God.
That notion was so interesting to me that he'd lived in one place all his life. And I, who've moved around, you know, innumerable times, I wanted to know what was that like to spend 100 years in the same town. So, you know, it was purely my own subjective curiosity that drove this.
Well, my grandmother is Zula Ludwig.
Zula! Great name.
When I had a child, I said, if it's a girl, I'll name her Zula. And she said, don't do it to her.
Great.
I had a boy. But I just wanted to share that, and I really enjoyed listening to the show.
Oh, thanks, and wish her a happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I think that's a terrific name. I can understand that maybe this woman's grandmother, you know, had a tough time now and then with that name, but what a great name.
Yeah. Memorable name.
Yeah. Nina, we're out of time.
Oh, my gosh, that was fast.
Yeah. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. I appreciate it.
Nina Ellis has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. She's the author of If I Live to Be 100, Lessons from the Centenarians. The publisher is Crown. And also, listeners, check out the website, ifilivetobe100.com. And then 100 is the numeral 100, ifilivetobe100.com.